what I'll talk about is some joint work with Vivek Shende and David Truman. The goal of the talk will be to try to kind of reformulate and in a certain sense maybe justify the notion of a cluster variety as just the characteristic geometry of moduli spaces in four-dimensional symplectic geometry. So sort of typically, cluster varieties of some family of spaces that are labeled by equivalence classes of quivers. They admit a certain combinatorial construction. And the most interesting examples are important objects in the geometric representation theory or in physics as certain spaces of vacua. But in this talk, I'm going to sort of specifically not focus on the motivating examples, but try to understand the theory and its full scope from some kind of uniform geometric perspective. So let me start by recalling the sort of usual combinatorial perspective. So how do I build a space out of a quiver? So the first first notion I need is actually, so let me, instead of talking about quiver, I'm going to talk about the notion of a seed S. So this is, in the talk, this is just some name for a collection of elements that I'll write V as V sub I in a lattice N. So N is going to be a lattice with a skew symmetric form. So what's the simplest place you get such a lattice? Well, say, take H1 of a surface sigma. Okay, so if I have this data, then I can read off a quiver just by taking the vertices to be these vi, and to take the pairings with respect to this form to give me the number of arrows between those vertices. But so let's sort of stick with this notion. So the basic sort of combinatorial definition is that if I have this datum, I can associate another such a new seed. Right, is mu ks, so this is something associated to picking one of these indices k. We say this is mutation at vk. Okay, so this is some, again, some seed. So again, it's some collection of elements in this fixed lattice N. And there's some sort of funny rule for what this is. So vi prime is given by some formula. If I'm looking at vk, vk prime is just minus vk. And otherwise, I take vi prime is given by taking vi, and I add some multiple of vk, which is just the max of the pairing between vi and vk, and zero. Okay, so I take that pairing if it's positive and add that multiple of vk. Otherwise, I discard it. So this is some sort of operation on seeds or on quivers, if you like. And one could sort of imagine iterating this process indefinitely. So I want to sort of build a space out of this initial data using these operations. And to do that, I need another sort of algebraic definition. Or geometric. So there's an associative map of algebraic tori. Called the cluster transformation. So what is this? So it's some map of, so first of all, if I have a lattice N, I get a torus, which is just spec of the group algebra of N. So the group algebra of a lattice is a Laurent polynomial ring. So this is just C star to some power N, little n, if N is the rank of N. So this cluster transformation, this is going to be some rational map from this torus to itself. Let's write it as mu k again. So for example, if N is H1 of sigma, then this torus, this is just the torus of rank one local systems on Sigma, so maps from the fundamental group to C star. And what do I have to do to tell you a map like this? Well, if I have an element little n of this lattice, then I get a function on this torus. If I write that function as z to the little n, I just have to tell you how this pulled back under this map. And then the rule is that, the definition is that this is zn pulls back to zn times 1 plus z to the vk times the pairing between n and vk. Okay, so I've told you some way to take a quiver or the seed, produce another seed. I get an associated map of algebraic tori. And now to build a space, we just glue together tori along these rational maps. So.
And so does this have an interpretation, geometric interpretation of the working system?
That's the talk. so, yeah, good question. So just to finish the thought, so the cluster variety, it's just what you get by glue together infinitely many tori along all possible sequences or all possible compositions along sequences of these. Okay, so what do I want to do? So I sort of handed you this sort of arbitrary looking formula here. And the plan for the talk is that I want to forget that I told you that formula, and I instead want to derive it by lifting mutation of seeds from an operation on homology classes to an operation on actual curves representing those classes. And then from there to an operation on Lagrangian skeleta. And so from there, sort of ultimately, we'll work backwards and say, well, if we were studying any four manifold with a skeleton of a certain pretty natural kind, then these kinds of formulas are forced upon us ultimately. Okay, so what do I mean by lift this operation to an operation on curves? Well, let's, so rather than talking about seeds now, let's say that let's talk about configurations of curves. So now let's let C, say script C, is going to be a collection CI of immersed oriented curves on sigma. So I want to, so of course, if I give you that data, and just remembering their homology classes, I get this data. So I want some operation on these curves that descends to that operation. So there's a pretty natural thing to do. So let me just tell it to you by an example. So let's say that my surface sigma is just a two torus.
Should I just take some sigma, which has that lattice?
Yeah, just take some sigma. So I'm going to sort of now, from now on, I'm assuming n is of this form. Mm-hmm. But of course, if n was not of this form, but it just had some skew symmetric form, I could always embed it, if you like, in H1 of some surface. So there's really no loss of generality. Maybe I should use these flashy colors. So let's say I have three curves, C1, C2, and C3. So let's talk about if I mutate it, this green curve C2, what's the rule going to be? Well, so I'm supposed to reverse the homology class here, so I should just leave this curve alone, but reverse its orientation. And now I need to sort of twist these other curves in some way that depends on the sign of how they intersected the green curve, because that's what this max with zero is saying. Let's just say, so let's sort of pick a convention that this is a positive intersection and this is a negative one. So I'm just going to take each of these curves, or maybe I should write, C3, C2 prime, this was C2 but reversed. And then more generally, we'll take Ci prime to be Ci, but twisted around C2 at each positive intersection. So this red curve, we declared it that its intersection with the green curve was negative, so we just leave it alone. The blue curve has this intersection that we call positive, so I'm just going to take the blue curve and just right around the green curve, I'm going to twist it like that. You pick some conventions about, what's positive and what negative. And ultimately, of course, there's a bit of a lie because there's a Dane twist ambiguity in that was sort of arbitrarily fixed. Here are some conventions for a reasonable operation, and there'll be a better sort of symplectic statement in a minute that sort of tells you why this is the right thing. What's the kind of key point? What does this buy you really? Of course, I had to make some, if I started with this data, I had to make some choices to pick actual curves. But without picking any other choices, I'm already secretly talking about some symplectic geometry here. So I claim that this collection of curves is equivalent to the data of a symplectic fourfold with a sort of preferred Lagrangian skeleton. How is this step going to work here? I'm going to tell you some. Let's write W subscript C is going to be this four manifold. This is some Weinstein four manifold given by attaching handles. To the leftward conormal lifts so each curve ci on the surface sigma I can lift that up to a curve in the boundary of the cotangent bundle of sigma. And I'm going to call this lambda I. So this is something, this is a curve in the boundary at infinity of T star sigma. So what does attaching these handles mean? So this is going to be the union. It's something built out of, I take T star of sigma, and I'm going to attach cotangent bundles of a collection of disks, a disk for every curve, for every CI. And these disks get attached sort of along these curves at the boundary of T star sigma. So I'll draw a picture in a second to try to indicate what this means. But when I say that this manifold is going to come with the natural Lagrangian skeleton, what I mean is that the whole thing retracts onto a singular Lagrangian L sub C, which as a topological space is just the union of sigma sitting in cotangent bundle sigma and these disks sitting in their cotangent bundles, where these are being attached along the curves CI and sigma. So this manifold that we're building is something that retracts onto just the union of sigma and a bunch of disks glued along the curves that we chose. So I can't draw W because I don't know how to draw four-dimensional things, but let me draw the 1D version of what I just said. So let's say, rather than, let's let T star sigma be just T star R. Okay, so I'd be saying something like, well, I have R in T star of R. So the analog of one of these curves CI is going to be now an embedded S0 in here. So let's say that S0 is these two points. I needed a choice of conormals to those points. So that means here these points should come with some choice of direction. So let's say they're both co-directed to the right. So these are this is sort of C here. And then when I say sort of take the conormal lifts of those, well, that direction tells me one way to lift these up to the boundary of this T star R. So these points up here are what lambda would look like in one dimension. And then when I say attach these Weinstein handles, well, here I'm just attaching one disks. So that's going to be an interval. And that interval is just something that kind of goes along, is attached to the boundary along those points, and then goes down and hits the zero section. And then I'm attaching a kind of symplectic neighborhood of that one disk. Okay, so this is D1 in T star D1. So here, this is just a funny way of saying build a symplectic annulus out of T star of R by attaching an interval. Okay, so this is the sort of cartoon of what we want to talk about now in four dimensions. So is that okay? All right. So what are some examples of so what kinds of things are WC? For example, let's say I take P2 minus a smooth elliptic curve. So I could describe this as a handle attachment. This is W sub, take a torus again, and now take three curves to be these three curves. Three, I think. Oh no, okay, you're right, two.
The way it's drawn. So the diagonal one means the other one's in 2 points, but the other two meet in three.
No, it's three, because this, so let's take the diagonal one, and you're right. And if I pick any two, they all intersect the corner point, and they all also intersect at those 2 points. So it is three. So the quiver here is the 3-3-3 quiver. Okay. So, I mean, more generally, in terms of the toric diagram for P2, these curves are just the sort of inward directions from the corners of the toric diagram. There's some more general okay, so there's some sort of class of examples. Here's another class of examples, which for us at least was part of the immediate motivation. So there's a lot of interesting examples of cluster varieties that I said at the beginning. So this is P2. Here's a take this curve here that comes from that's the image of a vector in R2, and that vector is this inward pointing vector from the corner of the toric diagram. So this is a way of if you were to try to describe sort of how that handle description works, you might think of P2. So P2 has a moment vibration over the toric diagram. The boundary, the preimage of the boundary, is a singular elliptic curve. And attaching these handles is kind of what happens if you smooth out the singularities in that toric divisor. In terms of as you smooth out the singularity in the boundary, you can think of that as introducing a singular fiber in the moment vibration over the interior. And then that singularity has a vanishing thimble that you pull into some fiber in the middle of the diagram. So that's how you wind up with P2 with some handles attached. So another class of examples are, suppose you have some other surface, S, as opposed to sigma, and suppose you have a bipartite graph drawn in S. Okay, then there's sort of some examples we studied in other previous work with Eric Zaslow. If I have gamma in S, a bipartite graph, then I get there's a construction of an exact Lagrangian sigma in T star of S. So in terms of this picture, sigma is something whose image in the base is this green region. Yeah. And this Lagrangian is such that if I take the intersection of sigma and S, this is exactly the bipartite graph, this graph itself. So from that point of view, I could think of, okay, if I have a bipartite graph, I have this configuration of two smooth Lagrangians. And I could, another way of saying this is that if I take the union of sigma and S, this is the same as sigma union the faces of the graph. Right, so each face of the graph that's sitting in the zero section, it's a Lagrangian disk. If I'm telling you that S comes in and meets the zero section along the graph, then the zero section sort of decomposes into a union of Lagrangian disks ending on sigma. And so in a sense, this construction is, and sort of the resulting handle attachment is just a way of describing how do I reconstruct T star of S from the point of view of this one particular Lagrangian sigma. Well, I take a neighborhood of sigma, and then I have to glue in some other pieces that capture the topology of S. Okay. So what Yeah, you could also imagine if I took, I'm sort of specific, so there's a bunch of disks in play that I'm specifically wanting to think of as Lagrangian disks, but if you were in some hyperkähler Bohr manifold and you had a holomorphic disk, you might imagine doing a rotation that turns that into a Lagrangian disk. So if I have a spectral, note that,
spectral curve is holomorphic, is not.
That's right. In particular, if I have a Lagrangian with a bunch of Lagrangian disks ending on it, and if there's a primitive of the symplectic form sitting around, well, that's telling me that the integral of that one form around the boundary of the disk has to be zero. So it's telling you that your Lagrangian that you're attaching these disks to has to be exact, basically. So a spectral curve is not a good candidate for something that I'm explicitly describing here because, in general, part of the point is that the Liouville form has lots of interesting integrals around cycles in the spectral curve.
But in this particular example, bipartite graph, sigma was a spectral curve, right? If you fill in some extra disks. This was the way.
It's
kind of spectral curve, right? They put these twisted ribbons and then they put extra this.
The point is, if you start from the holomorphic spectral curve, then you need to do some sort of hyperkähler rotation to get Lagrangian disks. And the point of what we were trying to say here was really that you have a canonical embedding into the cotangent bundle that is not the ramified cover, but this is sort of very special.
The curve is a Lagrangian
Yeah, but note, here I'm talking about it. Here I'm talking about a Lagrangian that's, look, if this is the projection, if I'm saying that if the Lagrangian that has this property is definitely not a spectral curve, just for reasons of thinking about integrals of the Lie form around it. I mean, if S is a Riemann surface, the intersection of some other algebraic curve in T star of S is not going to meet it in this sort of very non-transverse way. I mean, the answer to, was more in the examples where there are spectral curves around, this is sort of morally the spectral curve, but it's a little bit, the details are a little bit different of the exact Lagrangian we're thinking of. So one thing that anytime I have a Lagrangian disk, ending on sigma, so there's an operation that I can associate. I can do a kind of surgery on this disk to produce a new Lagrangian sigma prime. So this is, so there's a family of Lagrangians bounding Lagrangian disks, where I degenerate this disk down to a singular point, and I resolve it in some way to obtain a new sigma prime, which in general is not Hamiltonian isotopic. To the original one. So another way of saying this sort of as a notion that this is a kind of operation for producing new Lagrangians. This was studied by Meilin Yao. You can think of it as part of a, it fits into a two-parameter family. So there's an R2 family of not necessarily exact Lagrangians in the four manifold where these are living, where I'm sort of focusing on some slice here where I have Lagrangians that bound a Lagrangian disk. And as I, if I were to move away from that line in this two-parameter family, my cylinder ceases to be exact, and this disk goes from being Lagrangian to being holomorphic. So this is part of what I was saying earlier. So describing this as a sort of contraction of this singular Lagrangian configuration and redeformation into a different configuration, I can describe the same picture as I take this piece of the Lagrangian skeleton and I keep it smooth, but I lose track of part of the skeleton in the process. So we've been talking about
so this operation on the curve such that
That's right. So what do I want to, well, okay, before I say anything about pentagons, there's some statement that I need to make, which is, so the sense in this, in which this was the sort of correct operation, so if, so there exists a symplectomorphism let's call it mute sub k that goes from, so if I start with some curves script C, I have this manifold WC. If I mutate the curve configuration, I get a new C prime. And the symplectic manifold that I have is invariant under this operation on the curves. And this has the property that, well, I have sigma sort of sits in here in a certain way, and it sits in the original manifold in a certain way. So let's call sigma prime the pre-image of sigma as it sits in this new skeleton. So this is sort of saying I can think of this as an operation on not just a disk, but on this whole skeleton of W. And the sort of smooth part of the skeleton over here is related to the original sigma in LC by disk surgery. Okay. So just from the point of view of symplectic geometry, this is really the punchline of the talk right here. So the sort of new statement is that is the answer to the question, well, suppose I have a surface and I have a couple different disks, Lagrangian disk ending on it. Each of those is a means of producing a new distinct Lagrangian in this manifold. But if I just study this family here, it's not obvious what should happen to the other disks that might be attached to the surface. I have to figure out some way of pulling them through this transition. So once you do that, now I can think of this as an operation on Lagrangians that can really be iterated to get sort of lots and lots of exact Lagrangians. All right, so now.
Which C is a different item, but sigma inside the same symplectic manifold.
Yeah, that's right. It's different. You get a collection of exact Lagrangians in the same manifold that are all, abstractly, if I just tell you I have two things related by this surgery, they'll be homeomorphic canonically only up to a Dane twist. So that was, there was some convention earlier about how to choose that identification, essentially.
Are they talking about the disk themselves or sigma?
The sigma. Yeah.
What do you say, collection? So each C is one sigma, right?
That's right. So now I can. Once you promote this disk surgery to an operation on the whole skeleton, that each skeleton of this form has this sort of natural smooth part. Sort of, I throw out the disk parts. So every sort of core of the skeletons that I produce in this way gives me a new exact Lagrangian in this manifold. So
sigma or sigma union disk?
It's sigma. I mean, sigma is a smooth exact Lagrangian, and we're thinking about this operation on the smooth Lagrangian as an operation that transforms one sort of singular skeleton into another.
And what do you call it exact? Sorry.
It's exact because, in the sense that, this comes with a natural primitive of the symplectic form.
Yes.
So the restriction of that one form to each of these Lagrangians is an exact one form. Which again, you should think of as a kind of hallmark of the fact that these are Lagrangians that bound lots of Lagrangian disks.
I guess the one for me in this type of sigmas are like PDQ, right? Where Q is a coordinate of the sigma and P is on the fiber.
Right, right.
So just zero on sigma?
It doesn't have to be zero on sigma, but it's exact on sigma.
Yeah. But in the moment, is it also exact on the disks or on the sigma?
Well, anything's exact on a disk, right? Because the disk is contractible. But saying that, you know, this cycle in sigma, that the integral of the primitive around there is zero, is a consequence of saying that the integral of the symplectic form over this disk here is zero, which is automatic if that disk is Lagrangian. Okay, so now there's an obvious question. Which is, so I know that as I iterate this mutation process, I know that there's sort of one fixed symplectic manifold where this is happening. I can ask, what's the relation between the inclusions? On the one hand, I have, so we started with some formula relating local systems on sigma to local systems on sigma, or here let's say sigma prime, which is homeomorphic to sigma. So now that both of sort of sigma and sigma prime live in the same manifold, well, each of these can be regarded as a sort of separate subspace of Lagrangian brains in WC. Okay, so what's a Lagrangian brain? It's just some Lagrangian equipped with a local system. So here I have two Lagrangians. There's two different tori of abelian brains supported on them. So one of the, how do you approach this question? Well, anytime you're studying a Weinstein manifold with a Lagrangian skeleton, this gives you a convenient model for A-brains. In the form of microlocal sheaves. Along the skeleton. So this is a sort of famous proposal of Kontsevich. The language of microlocal sheaves is something that was developed in the 90s by Kashiwara and Shapira, and then this sort of theme of localizing Foucaultian categories along Lagrangians is a sort of important theme in the work of a lot of other people since then. So if we're studying manifolds that come to us with a natural skeleton, the point is that we have a good computational way to talk about questions like this. So let me first, maybe let me just give a sort of very zeroth order idea of what is a microlocal sheaf. It's sort of whatever it is, so it's some sort of sheaf-like object localized along this singular Lagrangian. But rather than having a sort of stock at every point, which is a vector space or a chain complex, like a local system, it's going to be something that, maybe let me just give a name for category. So let's say that, so let's let mu loc of L sub C, this is going to be the DG category of microlocal sheaves. On L sub C, so if I have an object F, sigma plus L sub C is sigma union the disks, which I erased, but yeah.
Deformations of collections of sigma, copies of sigmas and disks.
Well, the point is exactly that these are, I mean, this is a description of A-brains in all of WC.
Yeah.
Now I can talk about, so. The point is that because sort of by definition, W retracts onto L, I can shrink it until it's sort of supported in a very, very close neighborhood. So now I can talk, so rather than giving I want to sort of make a statement before I give any kind of real definition, but just a rough idea. So whatever a microlocal sheaf is, I can talk about its stalks at points of LC. And say, rather than this being a, what kind of object is the stalk of a microlocal sheaf at a point in L sub C, this is a representation of a quiver. That measures how singular L is at P.
So I adapt some of many pieces of this skeleton, and then whenever we meet at a point, I deform my sections. I deform my morphisms. And this deformation is a good representation. I mean, the Morgan-Tarn equation for this deformation.
That could be,
can you get an example?
Yes. Let me give a statement that just takes this category as a sort of black box, and then we can talk about examples.
This was some variable dimensions or only?
In principle, this works for any for a Weinstein manifold in any dimension. I mean, that's a sort of conjecture. And so sort of what we're saying here is, well, let's just sort of take that conjecture as a definition and get to work.
So this is your definition of A-brains.
Yeah.
And then you want to match them.
Yeah. But in particular, there's a sensible notion of what is an A-brain supported on sigma.
Yes.
I just asked that the stalk of my sheaf on the interiors of the disks are zero. So with that definition in hand, now you can try to prove a result. So first you have to sort of so a downside of the formalism, if you like, is that if I change the skeleton, so first I have to produce by hand an equivalence between the sheaf categories before and after. But once you do that, it's very computable. So I have mu loc of L sub C and mu loc of LC prime. And as we just said, sort of each of these contains in a natural way local systems on sigma and sigma prime. And this commutes with our sort of previous description of this birational map.
Is it a clarification?
Yeah. I mean, it's promoting the definition of the variety to a definition of a category that recovers the variety as a moduli space. It's another way of saying what this is saying. So if I look at the moduli space of microlocal sheaves, take the component of that containing loc 1 of sigma, this is saying that that automatically is going to contain another algebraic torus that looks like loc 1 sigma prime that's related in this way. And because, you know, this operation was something that I could iterate as far as I like, I deduce that that moduli space has to contain all of these tori.
Yeah.
And I mean, another thing is, I mean, you might think that the construction of this four manifold is a little artificial, but it's kind of generic description of, if I pick a single Lagrangian, you might have some Lagrangian of interest and not know all of these Lagrangian disks, but if they're sitting out there somewhere, which again you should sort of, you know, expect that those are kind of things you have to attach to. If the topology of your whole manifold is more complicated than the topology of a neighborhood, these disks are the kind of thing that relate that discrepancy. So it's a very natural thing to find lying around. Okay. Okay. So here's the sort of punchline in terms of what the original goal I stated was. I don't know how long I've been talking, and I should probably sort of maybe close the formal talk, and then I can say more about microlocal sheaves if anyone wants.
You have to just end.
Oh, I haven't even paid any attention to how long I've been talking, so I don't know how much. Let's do that.
Okay, resume in 5 minutes.
Right.
I mean, in two Ligier systems, sigma is a link plane tau C, and the moduli space of Ligier its bundles is a specific plane.
Yeah, that's right.
In the moduli space of Ligier.
Yeah, that's totally correct. So,
is this related to this?
Well, that's the kind of the point is that, you know, there you have some very special sort of nice examples where you know their meaning in terms of this context of in A-brains and T-star of the UV curve. But this is saying that, you know, that geometric term interpretation is really kind of universal. Like any...
No, I understand that's in that specific example, I understand.
So in that example, if you want to get down to details, then you also need to... You know, there is this sort of funny thing that, here I really, you know, it was important at various steps that, or it was at least meaningful that I was thinking of the structure in terms of Lagrangian disks. So if you want to relate it to the way you usually think of spectral curves, well, those are not things that bound lots of Lagrangian disks. So to relate that picture to this picture in the details, you need to do something non-trivial.
The sigma is like the half-spectral curve, and then you have a pattern the bi-spectral curve in a given class of H. Not quite H.
I mean, the. Sorry, say your statement again.
Yeah.
which is to this point, let me trade this.
This is the actual act.
I mean,
like, so we get an eight right out of Sigma.
I mean, part of the point is also to kind of separate out, you know, what's what part of the structure really comes from the complex geometry and what's sort of purely about real symplectic geometry.
So the way I understand different seeds, from a kind of different chamber where there has to be approximation, say, is
I mean, so let me make another comment, which is, I mean, the kind of question that we were trying to address was also the kind of question like, well, is every chart represented by a spectral curve,
yes,
by a chamber in some chamber in the Coulomb branch? And here, so the we don't quite understand that yet, but at least the sort of this is the sort of natural geometric language for addressing that question.
Yeah, so you keep however you want.
Exactly. Exactly. So I don't need to sort of and it, you know, I don't know, even if I start with, you know, a spectral curve or some sort of exact, you know, maybe a deformation of a spectral curve to something exact, you can keep performing this project, this process to get more and more Lagrangians. I don't know if the cluster chart coming from every Lagrangian you produce in this way, you know, this provides a geometric interpretation, but it's not clear that the Lagrangians you produce during this process are going to be sort of equivalent to real spectral curves if you keep mutating. But you know that there'll be some Lagrangians. But are they? Yeah. But even if you were, I mean, like you might think, like here, my story is it's naturally formulated in terms of the sigma, and this might be isotopic through some very sort of you know, there might be some sort of spectral curve sitting at a point over here in the moduli space of Lagrangians up to smooth isotopy. But this is, you know, in the sort of collection of actual spectral curves that has some chamber decomposition. Chambers give you some cluster charts. This tells you at least you have a process for describing more cluster charts geometrically in terms of the Lagrangians you get from this process. So you have a framework for understanding where all the charts come from geometrically, but it's not obvious whether everything you produce in that geometric process comes from something in the sort of holomorphic geometry.
So I understand. So this is a parameterization of all A rank, say it's kind of C.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, if I take a spectral curve, it's one of these ranks.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Which one? I mean, which point?
Wait, which?
Which micro-local shift is represents a spectral curve?
Are you supposed to just take the spectral curve and sort of deform it onto the Lagrangians?
Yeah. Yes.
There's at least a heuristic picture that if you had, so of course, if you imagine, here's the zero section.
The suspicion is that whenever the spectral curve lies in the Coulomb, in the point of the Coulomb branch, which lies in a specific chart, the spectral curve can be projected up to sigma.
Okay, let me say something. Tell me if it's what you said. I mean, I'd like to say something like, imagine here's your spectral curve,
yes.
And you have some holomorphic disk bound, like lying above some path. That's right. Typically, you don't. Imagine you.
So you do is exactly where something special should happen.
That's well. I'm trying exactly to sort of say, you know, this disk here is if you do some hyperlocal. This local family is a local picture of hyperkalar rotation in a neighborhood of the disk. So there's should be some precise thing you could say relating this disk to a kind of Lagrangian disk that I was talking about. But exactly how what you'd need to do to make that precise is a little hairy.
If I were in some place like the one that searches on, like the point, the special point where all the charges align.
Ah, that's the kind of place, yeah.
And sigma should be literally the same as the spectral curve, because it bounds on the maximal set of holomorphic disks.
That's right, yeah.
And then there is what the quiver leads to.
That's an interesting statement. Is that spectral curve, that's something more general. I mean, there's another. In some cases, I also have, you know, a most singular spectral curve.
No, that's something.
This is something
a
more general.
Point in the Coulomb branch where all the spectral charges align,
mm-hmm.
and then where all the Wolfson matches really come together.
Mm-hmm.
So it means that there is a maximum number of holomorphic
mm-hmm.
disks, I guess.
No, that's exact. Because then you would do the. I mean, as I do. Hyperkalar rotation
yeah.
to change the phase of those disks, they all become Lagrangian at the same
time.
Yeah, yeah.
And that point, that's where the derivative and I have the degree. By comparing the.
So, what does that mean exactly? I mean.
It's a point where all the brains are simultaneously.
I mean, I could get the quiver anywhere if I allow myself to rotate phases.
They want to prove that you can get a quiver describing the previous spectrum of a generic Ichimoku space.
Mm-hmm.
And they do it for someone who's going at that point.
Mm.
I guess at that point, the spectral curve is the same as sigma.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's another point to be made, which was kind of, I mean, what we were found very clarifying in this earlier work was that even if you're talking about spectral curves, you know, the asymptotics of those spectral curves is always sort of in a right above the poles in the UV curve, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have a spectral curve where it's going off to infinity sort of near the poles of the Higgs field. But I mean, explicitly, the sort of Lagrangian that I was trying to name here as a reference is something that's where the asymptotics are all around. You know, they're far. The point is, you have Hamiltonian isotopies that change the asymptotics of the curve at infinity, and it's very enlightening to think about those isotopies as well. So. Something like this is a very illuminating object to understand where the bipartite graph comes from, but it's something that's sort of trivially different from the spectral curve insofar as its asymptotics are of a very different kind.
So
here you can include stable charges. Oh, no, I was going to say, if there's anything else that you can understand, tell us. Maybe tell us, and we'll...
No, this is good. I mean, I...
Well, I would love to hear more about mathematical shifts and definition. But can I ask, so here you didn't have flavor charges, and you add them immediately.
Remind me what that means for a mathematical...
Yeah, the lattice was symplectic, the symplectic pairing.
Uh-huh.
What if you have a Poisson pairing? Meaning that some of the cluster coordinates are just parameters, they're not parameters in the space, but they're just numbers.
I mean, isn't that something that you have as as soon as you have a punctured, the spectral, I mean, the very, I would say, I mean, by default, I would include those parameters in part of the moduli space. I mean, this is, this moduli space has, even I just look at the single torus. I mean, if I want a, this is Poisson and fixes a symplectic leaf, I'm exactly fixing a holonomy around the punctures. But I don't think of that as fixed at the beginning of time. So what is this category explicitly? So suppose you have a so the local definition is so suppose you have a conical Lagrangian in the cotangent bundle of a manifold. So invariant under multiplication by positive reals. So Kashiwara and Shapira explained to you that there's a certain category, which I'll keep writing as mu loc of L, which is a category of sheaves on M with certain singular support, and the important insight here is that this so sheaves are local over the base, but in fact this category localizes, microlocalizes in a certain sense over the whole Lagrangian. So not just points in the base, but also point I can talk about its restriction to open sets in the fibers. So again, let me kind of just tell you how this works explicitly in the relevant example. So the Lagrangians we were talking about, the most complicated local behavior was just something that looked like, so if I have two curves intersecting, then at a neighborhood of that intersection in L sub C, I had a configuration that looked like a plane. Which is like sigma, and then two fins attached to it. Okay, and each of these fins, I mean, in R3 you can't see any difference, but if each of these is attached along a certain direction, or better yet, a certain sort of co-orientation. So here, so if this is L, T star R2, then mu loc of L, this is just representations of the A3 quiver. And what I was saying before about a stock of a microlocal sheaf at this intersection is a representation of some quiver. Here it's A3, and that's just saying, well, any small neighborhood I take of that intersection point is topologically as complicated as this picture here. So describing the sort of global category on this picture is the same information as the stock at a point can't be anything sort of more refined. There'll be brains that are supported on...
It's only the one and two end, right? So we do have something like these...
There'll be, the kinds of this, either simples or projectives will be things like, imagine, so I have the zero section, I have a brain that comes in from this side and then sort of swoops up around here, and then other ones that sort of come in from this side and then swoop down along this fin.
Yes.
So the things that are sort of hug these fins very closely in some configuration.
Mm-hmm.
But as a sheaf, how do I repackage this information? So ultimately, I need to understand stocks. So the data of, if I have F in here, so if I tell you I have a constructible sheaf on M with singular support along these fins, sort of the first order information is that, well, if I look away from each of these fins, I just have a local system in each of these quadrants. So a local system in the quadrant is essentially just a vector space. So I have, or complexes. So I have stocks A, B, C, and D. And then those lines with their codirections tell me that F also includes the data of some maps that go against the codirections. Well, that's what we're going to say. So right now, I'm working things a little bit backwards. The point is that you start with the definition of, so there's a general definition of sheaves on M. Now I can talk about the singular support of a sheaf.
Mm-hmm.
And if I tell you that I consider sheaves with some prescribed singular support, we're now going to learn that to such an object, which a priori is something local over M, is also local in a certain sense over the fins. So that's what we're extending our notion of a sheaf to a notion, which is an object on N, to our notion of a microlocal sheaf, which is an object over this whole configuration.
So L involves the fins.
L involves the fins. L is the union of R2 with these two fins.
And in the end, the picture is going to be symmetric. I mean, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, at the end, there's...
in other words, I don't need to know that this was in... This is T star of R2 with a fixed base.
I mean, at the end of the day, we're going to be interested in, you know, W is some nonlinear manifold. It's not a cotangent bundle. In the end of the day, you want to think about skeleton of nonlinear things, but you can think about microlocal sheaves in terms of sort of linear charts. So you might think about, I choose some neighborhood of a point like this in LC, and I trivialize it by identifying a neighborhood of it with T star of R2, and that's sort of like choosing coordinates on a smooth manifold.
So clearly on sigma, you have vector space in each patch that curves.
Right.
And
right.
Maps the cost of curves.
Exactly.
Okay.
So I have, so here's some information that I have in just a sheaf on M, and the equivalence here is, well, if I, there's a relation here, if I know three of these, say B, C, and D, and I just remember that part of the data, there's a relation that A is actually the, so A is the cone over B plus D mapping to M, or B plus C mapping to D. Okay, so I only really needed an A3 worth of information, or maybe with the shift or something. So there's sort of the equivalence in terms of these stocks, but now the point is I can talk about, if I choose a point up on L now, you know, this sits above some one of these maps, so I can talk about a microlocal stock. Which is just going to be the cone over sort of the map in the base that it sits above. Okay, so here's our category.
Can you same as one of the zero.
That's right. That's right. I mean, the fact that this relation is there gives you this. Okay. So here's this sort of local linear theory. But now that you know the construction we were talking about these. If I build a WC by doing this handle attachment, then L sub C is automatically kind of covered by these. If you like, it's built out of out of charts.
When I think about A, B, and A, C, and D as morph spaces or morphisms from this plane into some other simple plane, such like a distant fiber of L sigma.
I mean, in some sense, insofar as, I mean, if I had another, I mean, if I have a brain, I have a local system on that brain. So if my brain is the zero section, or let's do an instrument, if my brain is something that sort of some smoothing of this fin and the right half plane, then that local then a local system on that brain corresponds to a microlocal sheaf where all of the where A and C are zero. If A and C are zero, but say B and D are rank one, then yeah.
Well, suppose something gives me a plane in the total manifold.
Mm-hmm.
How do I find the data A, B, C, and D?
It would be something like you say, well, there's a flow that retracts W onto L.
Yes.
So if I have some Lagrangian off in the bulk of W, under this flow, it gets smushed. Well,
because instead of projecting the L on sigma, some part of it is going on the basis.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So here I'm going to have sigma sitting inside L sub C ultimately. If I have some other Lagrangian that's not sigma, you're right. That flow is going to get smooshed onto the disks in some complicated way.
Is there any description of this flow? Canonical description of the flow?
I mean, I never tried to write it down, but you could probably do it pretty easily. The point is that, in each of the thing is built out of cotangent bundles. On T star of M, it's just the flow given by, peak.
Cannot just be compressing the fiber.
On T star M, it's just compressing the fiber.
But that would send everything to M.
But you could. Subordinate that flow by saying I want it to become stationary near this fin.
Yes.
And now I have something that sort of leaves this fin alone but smooshes everything else down. That you can describe pretty explicitly. And then, in describing the handle construction, there's a certain amount of differential topology you need to think about. Like, I do this attachment, I sort of smooth some corners, I have to glue together the symplectic structures. When you were sort of learning how to do that, you could probably learn how to describe the flow. And
when you say the skeleton, the Lacantian skeleton,
mm-hmm.
how do you know the collection of Lacantians is a skeleton? It's a fact, it's tau C. This tau of sigma, sigma by itself is not a skeleton, tau sigma. But sigma plus this collection of this.
It has to, it's some version of, you need a Hamiltonian flow that retracts W onto the skeleton. That's a minimal requirement. And there's some technical things like you have a certain convexity condition on the contact boundary.
If the manifold was this now sigma, then I would just sigma would be able to get it. But because you added these extra things.
Something I should say, of course.
More than sigma.
I mean, you really think of the skeleton as a skeleton of the manifold together with some boundary condition, probably. And I think of this as a skeleton of R of T star R2, but with some non-empty boundary condition.
So you're considering the Lagrangian things that are about to go to infinity in particular directions?
Sure. And at the end of the day, maybe I should have said that, I mean, it was kind of implicit. When I said start with sigma and attach a bunch of disks, I was fine with sigma having boundary. Of course, in interesting cases, it typically will have boundary. And in that case, these are brains that are going off to infinity along the boundary of sigma. It's like a spectral curve of a Hitchin system with punctures is a non-compact brain.
Yeah, but the disks don't always have a boundary to
do. Oh, that's true. The disk, I was certainly considering the situation where we had skeleton that looked like surface union disks, and the boundary was all in the boundary of sigma. The disks were filled to disks.
Usually it's not the case.
What do you mean usually it's not the case?
I don't know, I think the Hitchin system, I have sigma and a bunch of curves on it.
No, that's the case. I mean, you have a bunch of curves on it.
I mean, suppose Hitchin system for compact.
For a compact, you're right. And of course, there, you know, the space of brains doesn't have cluster charts. So, I mean, okay. Well, okay, there's another comment worth making, which is that, of course, once you, let's stay in this case, but I can look at brains that have rank more than one on sigma. Okay, so there's some, you know, there are sort of higher rank moduli spaces that now have cluster structures whose constituents are not tori, but are themselves spaces of higher rank local systems.
Yes.
So, but each of those pieces, but if you just start with closed sigma, that's a different thing.
It's related to having three.
So one of the things so there was an asterisk that I didn't mention, which was we said imagine you start with some homology classes and you pick some curves that lift those classes. Now you could start mutating those curves, but when you made that choice, you're secretly making a choice which is like choosing a potential and should really be choosing a potential in some way that I don't know how to make precise. So for example, in the same way, so if I talk about mutation of quivers with potential, the potential, one thing it does is it acts as, is it gives you an obstruction to mutating arbitrarily far. If I choose a bad potential on a quiver, then I might not be able to sort of mutate along any sequence I like. And in the same sense here, you know, I drew some toy example where where I got some picture like this. So if I look at the, if I, so in order to make sense of this, I needed a curve to be embedded. But if I do another mutation here, if I mutate at this diagonal curve now and think about what happens, I'm going to get some looped picture like this. And now at that looped picture, I don't know how to mutate at this curve. Okay. So there are sort of poor choices of lifting homology classes of curves you could make, where you might be obstructed from doing some arbitrary sequence of surgeries. What should happen, and what happens in the familiar examples, is that sitting above this four-manifold WC, there's some six-manifold. Like in the class S theory, you have the Calabi-Yau that would give you the theory in 2B that projects onto T star of the UV curve. So the relation in this relationship here, I was previously talking about Lagrangian disks in W. those disks are the pre-images of Lagrangian spheres up in this six manifold. So what we think is that, yeah, so we're kind of trying to think about how do you describe this. So just like now we were saying, okay, this four-dimensional geometry is totally general. What's the sort of general description of this six-dimensional geometry now? And in so he, the meaning of the quiver from the point of view of the six-manifold now is it's telling you that in the vertices of the quiver are Lagrangian spheres up here. So it may be that the potential that's encoded in the six-manifold, that obstructs mutation of collection of spheres up here, that should correspond to this obstruction to sequences of disk surgery down in the four-manifold.
So this is not the category of line operators.
Well, if that's right, but the category of line operators is something about non-compact brains in the six manifold, right? Well, okay. I mean, here's what we think should happen, because this is the game that I'm. Okay, so the game that people play all the time in representation theories of Ginzburg algebras is that functions on this space, or at least the A version of this space, are labeled by objects in this, there's a certain two-Calabi-Yau category that you can build out of the quiver. That's kind of the natural place to label functions in here. That quotient, that category is the quotient of the category of perfect modules over the Ginzburg algebra by the category of finite dimensional modules. So there should be some way of extracting that picture from this geometry where you say, I take the quotient of wrapped brains in here by compact brains, and I get the category of wrapped brains in the fourfold. That's a guess.
But somehow you need something that gives you an actual function of this space, right?
Yeah, and I mean, there's another, I mean, I didn't discuss A versus X in the talk, but this is really X that I'm talking about here. We're still trying to figure out the right way to state A in terms of this geometry.
Even if you want to, just saying they are fine. Like the Laurent polynomials in this, but the coordinates which remain Laurent polynomials don't.
Well, it's not always true. I mean, in particular, even when this is. You know, the X variety can have very few global functions.
It's along
with. We're at a level of abstraction where there's no base curve here, right?
No,
you're right, in certain examples, sure.
I see the same examples of Michael just made.
Yeah. And that's some, I mean, that's, I mean, this, I mean.
But when they are there, it's there.
When they are there.
I mean it's just a practical question. So if I multiply space of eight banks.
Uh-huh.
How do we get a function with all those things?
There are certain situations where you can see what to do, and this is related to, like for example, you might get a function on, like let's say you're, that's a maybe too degenerative example, but let's just do A2 quiver. So take a torus, and I have two curves like this. Or maybe, okay, the co-orientations are more enlightening than the orientations. So any microlocal sheaf on the, you know, the skeleton I build from this, I can restrict it to just get a sheaf on the torus with this singular support, because I build the whole category by gluing together these local pieces. So if I have a sheaf on the torus with this singular support, then I really just can see what are the cluster variables here. Because I can ask, what is the, you know, I choose a curve that is non-characteristic with respect to these co-oriented curves. So whenever it crosses one of these guys, it does so in the direction opposite to the hairs. So as per how I explained the example over there, you know, there are a sheaf has specialization maps across those curves in that direction.
Okay, so you can compose them.
So now I get a function, because I take a microlocal sheaf on the whole skeleton. That's a point in this moduli space. Restrict it to this part that sort of lives near a neighborhood of the T2. And now I can ask, what is the parallel transport around this loop? And that's something that might be zero, but it's a well-defined number. So that's how I would get a function.
Yes.
But
that big part is as a call plane that comes from the fiber of the toggles, and I'm looking at how the morphic space will more physically diminish to both the plane and the plane.
That's right, and this is why I was saying, like, you should think functions should be related to the wrapped category. I mean, because this curve is sort of like the conormal brain to that curve. That's some non-compact thing in W. But let me note again, sort of, in general, there might not be many global functions at all in this space. Like, if I look over there, there's no path that.
Can you do anything with the move lengths of paths?
Yeah, you should. I mean, there should be some calculus of, somehow you can associate, functions should be labeled by, you know, tropical points. Here you see, so that should be like h lower one of this torus. And you can see some of that, there's a cone in there, which is naturally labeled by these homology classes. And there's, I would imagine there should be some sort of calculus that tells you, well, if I look at the homology class in this direction, I don't get a number out of this path, but maybe there's some sort of web-like thing that there's some algorithm for defining. I don't know. But I mean, my question sort of does the physics tell me anything about line operators being related to this four manifold?
I mean, this is analogous to this C.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, line operators are literally called things that end on C, not the path. Come down.
So what are, can I see? You're right, so you want to say something like take a lamination and think of that, I can think of that as a brain which is conormal to that lamination. But how do I, do you have any guess for, to compute Homs, I have to think about wrapping in this category. And that wrapping is going to be sensitive to the boundary conditions, which is going to be sensitive, sort of need to know the, so to compute Homs there, I need to know about the details of the irregular singularity. Because I need to know the details of the asymptotics of that. Do you know why, so if I think of line operators as wrapping non-compact brains here, is that quotient category construction something that seems physically natural?
I mean, sounds good.
Should we take Harris?
Okay.